This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We go from the jazz saxophone of John Ellis to a live discussion with David Eisenman about the ethics of torture. Welcome, David.
Hi there, Steve.
I'm going to give the phone numbers early on today because we want to include listeners right from the start in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 to join in this discussion. That's 333-WILL in Champaign-Urbana. If it's a long-distance call, do use our toll-free line, 1-800-222-9455. So to begin with, what is torture?
And what are ethics? Over the last few weeks, I've been telling people that I'm going to be on this program and that this was the odd topic that I'd chosen. Steve actually asked me to come and discuss something else, and I thought about it for a while and called him up and said, I don't know that I can avoid talking about the ethics of torture. So in the first place, let's define terms. It's always a good place to start. Any dictionary will tell you that ethics is a subject that relates to right and wrong conduct. Not right and wrong thought, but right and wrong conduct. But of course, the question is whose conduct? And it, of course, would be very easy to talk about other people's ethics. And so I think that the challenge of this program is for listeners to consider whether they have any obligation with respect to the subject of torture. So now you asked me to define torture. Well, let me not define it, but let me just read a paragraph from an article that appeared after we signed up for this program, December 12, 2006, in the Manchester Guardian in England. And so these are not my words. These are the words of a journalist, widely respected, read in a serious newspaper. Quote, that the U.S. tortures routinely and systematically while prosecuting its war on terror can no longer be seriously disputed. The Detainee Abuse and Accountability Project, a coalition of academics and human rights groups, has documented the abuse or killing of 460 inmates of U.S. military prisons in Afghanistan, Iraq, and at Guantanamo Bay. This, it says, is necessarily a conservative figure. Many cases will remain unrecorded. The prisoners were beaten, raped, forced to abuse themselves, forced to maintain stress positions, and subjected to prolonged sleep deprivation and mock executions. The New York Times reports that prisoners held by the U.S. military at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan were made to stand for up to 13 days with their hands chained to the ceiling, naked, hooded, and unable to sleep. The Washington Post alleges that prisoners at the same air base were commonly blindfolded and thrown into walls, bound in painful positions, subjected to loud noises, and deprived of sleep while kept, like Jose Padilla. This is in the middle of an article that began discussing his case, like Padilla and the arrivals at Guantanamo in black hoods or spray-painted goggles. That's the end of the quote. The poet, the Scottish poet whose name goes out of my head because I'm 64 years old, but whose date is coming up, we all know who I mean. Bobby Burns said that, would God the gift he gie us to see ourselves as others see us? Well, that's how a journalist in England sees us at the moment. But before we get excited about this being an exclusively American thing, part of my homework for this program was to view the famous movie The Battle of Algiers, which told, as far as anybody can tell, as even-handedly as a movie possibly could, the story of the French attempt to fight terrorism in Algiers back in the 50s and early 60s when the Algerian people were trying to throw off the French colonial control of Algeria. That movie is very instructive. Everything that we've done or been accused of doing to our prisoners at Guantanamo and elsewhere was pioneered by the French, and you can see it in that movie. Waterboarding, this business of forcing people to stand, holding their hands above their heads, keeping them cold, keeping them wet. All of this is not new. So what's new?
And earlier in World War II times, of course, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo and other books describe torture in Japan and
and Germany.
Yes.
Now, in fact, precisely because there is that history of the use of torture by the fascist powers in the Second World War, I turned to a pre-Second World War dictionary for my definition of torture, just to remind us that we don't want to be contaminated by what happened later. And the dictionary I turned to was the favorite dictionary of my favorite author, Guy Davenport. A couple of weeks before he died, in one of his last letters to me, as he was reviewing his life, he wrote the following paragraph. Whatever ex nihil nihil fit made the tiger also made the lamb. Life is lethal. Our only obligation is to be intelligent, in which benevolence operates as a rational force. Davenport was not a Christian, but he greatly admired Jesus' teaching that love ought to be the first principle that we appeal to and also the last in every human activity. Here's how this paragraph continues. I shall never forget the old Iranian refugee on a flight to Copenhagen, speechless and patiently miserable. At Kastorp Airport, four handsome young Danes were waiting for him with an ambulance. Warm blankets, kind arms. Customs stood respectfully aside. He was a victim of torture for whom the Danes have a special hospital and sanctuary. They doubtless had a Farsi speaker on hand. Now, turning to Davenport's own favorite dictionary, the New World Dictionary of 1938, let me read the definition of torture. Torture is the act of inflicting excruciating pain from sheer cruelty or in hatred, revenge, or the like, specifically the infliction of such pain by judicial or quasi-judicial authority, especially in order to extort a confession or as part of a punishment. That definition was written before the Second World War. Now, in a way, today's program is a review of Ghost Plane, a book just out by Stephen Gray, G-R-E-Y. The subtitle is The True Story of the CIA Torture Program. The title may be a little bit overstated. The CIA didn't directly torture in all cases. In many cases, they simply owned airplanes that flew people to countries on our watch list as governments that torture and are known to torture. You've probably all heard of the story of the Canadian who was taken off a plane in New York City and zipped off to the Middle East, where in a Syrian prison he was held for more than a year. An entirely mistaken matter, apparently, in which he was in fact treated very badly. We've been outsourcing torture. We've also done some of it ourselves, though. The great benefit of Stephen Gray's book is that he managed to get records of flights of airplanes owned by or leased to the CIA and has documented that the flight patterns, the landings and takeoffs, completely coincide with stories told by a few people who have been released from Guantanamo or from Middle Eastern prisons, and who all of them, released because they were in there by mistake, have recounted the way they were treated. And it is entirely consistent with that earlier description from the Manchester Guardian. So anyway, what are we talking about here today? As I said at the start, ethics is right and wrong behavior, but whose behavior? And I'm talking today about mine, and I hope that you who are listening will start thinking about yours.
And we have a caller who's already wanting to join in. We're listening now with David Eisenman on Keeping the Faith. Line number one, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. It's interesting you sort of just said you're talking about your behavior, but you're not really talking about your behavior. You're talking about specific political behavior of the United States. And I would like you to broaden your discussion, since you're talking about the ethics of torture, to also talking about the torture, let's say, of Daniel Pearl, the torture of various other parties, whether it's in the Iranian prisons, whether it's in people captured by Al-Qaeda or some of the various insurgents in Iraq, in order to take this away from just the political and talk about the topic you propose, which is the ethics of torture, rather than turn this into a political discussion of blame and so on.
Thank you. Your call came just before I had a chance to do just what I think you want to do, which is avoid finger-pointing and blame. I don't want to dismiss what you just said, but frankly, I would summarize it as, Mommy, all the other kids are doing it.
No, I
do want to get to what your responsibility and my responsibility isn't for this, and I clearly am not responsible for Al-Qaeda, nor for Hitler, nor for what goes on in Israeli prisons or Palestinian prisons or northern African right. prisons. But what I think every American has to face is that if this is a democracy, we are responsible for what our government does. And I guess my question for the audience is, if my country has descended to the level of the people we claim we're better than, then what does that say about us?
If I could just bring it back, I'd like you to talk about the ethics of torture, which is what you proposed that to, which means on what basis can one make a decision, or is there any basis to make a decision about torture?
Okay, fine. If you want that, let's go right there. It's part of the program. Why not?
Can I say one thing else, and then I'll let you speak, get off?
Sure, go right ahead.
Because I'd like to talk about what do you do in situations where you're at war, which is what the situation is talking about, and you've captured someone who has information, et cetera, that you feel torture might or might not be helpful. And I know there's all sorts of theories about whether torture works or not. So I'd like you to talk about that and the ethics rather than the
practicalities.
What's the ethical basis?
Sure.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question.
It's a good question. It does take us to a place we were going to go anyway. I read with great interest in September of 2004 an article in the Atlantic magazine by Mark Bowden, who is the author of Black Hawk Down, in which he announced, and remember, this is months before we heard about Abu Ghraib, he announced that anybody who didn't think that the United States was using aggressive interrogation techniques that most people would call torture against the Al-Qaeda leaders that we had captured was a fool, that we were undoubtedly using those techniques. And he laid out the kind of dilemma that you have just sketched. What if you have in front of you a suspect that you have very strong reason to believe knows something which, if only you could get from him, might save lives? Now, Bowden chose to move the discussion away from Iraq and Al-Qaeda and give us a kind of a classic case. There was a German fellow who had kidnapped a boy and buried him in an underground airless box, who was caught by the police, happily told them that, yes, indeed, he had done all that, but he wasn't going to tell them where the kid was. Everyone had reason to believe that the boy's life would be over very soon if he couldn't be found. This man was defying the authorities. Sure, I did it. I'm just not going to tell you where he is. A policeman took it upon himself to slap the guy around, and he waterboarded him and got him to tell where the kid was. The kid was found. He was dead. The policeman was then hauled up in court for having abused the prisoner, because what he did do was against German law, against international law. He was acquitted. Now, Mark Bowden finished his article on the subject of what should we be doing in this war by saying that he thought the president had chosen exactly the right stance, namely repeatedly saying to the public that we are against torture, we don't sanction torture, we do not authorize the use of torture by our people, and we will punish people who practice torture. And then, having said all that, turn over the actual responsibility for interrogation to people who, in the end, will make individual decisions about whether they will advance the interrogation techniques they are using to levels that some people might call torture. Bowden argued that this is exactly how to handle it. If you take the gloves off officially, You will encourage every garden sadist anywhere in the CIA, the Army, your prisons to decide, of course, I'm angry enough this afternoon that I will beat up this prisoner, hang him by his thumbs, whatever happens to be available. That the principle that you had to maintain was that anybody who is an interrogator and who steps across that border into what is defined to be torture better be ready to answer for having done that in a court of law, and he better be able to argue convincingly to a jury that he had no choice except to do that. Now,
let's just start at that question. I know we'll continue with more, but we do have another caller who wants to join in. Let's see if this is connected or something else. Yes, line number four, you're on Keeping the Faith.
Hi. This is amazing because I just finished watching The Battle of Algiers this afternoon and thought everyone in this country should see this movie because of exactly the issues you're talking about. There was a couple of things about the movie that I think would be good to bring up. First of all, I was sitting there thinking after I saw it, how can we get the word out that people should see this movie? Because it was so well done and so brought out what both sides were trying to do, which I thought was really a fair thing to see. But there was a scene where the French general is talking and says, well, France has to decide if they want to keep Algiers, and then if they do, they have to accept the consequences. And
I agree with you, by the way, that was one of the most extraordinary moments in the movie.
Wasn't it? It was wonderful. And I think we need to bring that to our country. We need to bring that to the people of this country and say, you know, if we need to be there, if we need to use these techniques, then open up and say we need to use them, which I think is wrong, of course, but people should be aware that those are out there and being used, and they should stop it if they don't believe in it. And I think most people in this country don't believe in it, but I also think they're unaware. And the other thing about the movie that amazed me was in 2003, this was shown to our military leaders, and I don't think they learned anything.
Or maybe they did. Maybe they learned the specific techniques that we now know that they're using and that are shown graphically in that movie.
Yeah, I guess that's pretty scary.
But thank you
for
the comment.
That's not what I would have learned.
Thank you very much for the call. Let me give the numbers so others can call us. 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, if it's a long-distance call, including from the Internet, you may call 1-800-222-9455. David, you want to respond to that issue?
Absolutely. I think it's very interesting that the caller has mentioned a visual documentary. You can read all you want about torture, but actually seeing what apparently are pretty accurate portrayals of what it looks like, which is what the Battle of Algiers does, has a totally different effect on us from merely reading words on a page.
I'll disagree. I still remember the torture described in a book I read as a teenager about World War II, partly because my imagination was so vivid about it, I think, and some of the things that were written about could not have been filmed even today.
Well, put it this way, language has become so corrupted in the last few years. I mean, we have a president who talks about enhanced interrogation techniques or aggressive interrogation techniques. We have so much. We are now in 1984. I mean, the author was just a little bit off by 20 years. But I honestly think that we are now living in a visual society. Nobody reads books anymore. Certainly George Bush never read one. The rumor this week is that he's gotten around to watching The Battle of Algiers. It would be good for him if he had. But I want now to say that I wrote a letter to the News Gazette, not entirely facetiously, a few weeks back saying that I thought torture was in the same category with pornography, which was famously commented upon by a Supreme Court justice who said he couldn't define it, but he knew it when he saw it. I honestly think that every congressman should be required to watch interrogation videos chosen at random, and you know that they are being made in CIA prisons and Guantanamo. I think everybody who claims to represent us in Washington should spend a certain number of hours unrelievedly watching real-time videotapes of what is being done in our name. And if they can still say it's not torture, then I will, of course, be relieved.
We have another caller, this time on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, David Eisenman.
Hi, I'm perfectly happy with you looking at the political dimensions of this. After all, as you pointed out, it is our polity that is doing this. And I don't know if you noticed this week that the Army manual was released, and it prohibits torture but allows coercion. So your comment about it being Orwellian is perfectly applicable, it seems. I don't know if you noticed, but there was an open house at the Military Intelligence Unit of the National Guard office here in Urbana this week, and they were going to be displaying an interrogation room. I'm not making that up. I didn't go over. I don't know if anybody went over in orange suits to demonstrate or anything like that. I share your revulsion. I don't know if you also noticed this week that Gonzalez was pretty much grilled at the Judiciary Committee, not long enough, but pretty intensely by Patrick Leahy, and Richard Durbin actually also spoke up and after his supposed embarrassing remarks some years ago. I'm glad that he's actually rising to the occasion a little bit. Arar is still banned from this country, even though the Canadian government has investigated him thoroughly. And you can go to C-SPAN and view this last segment of the first of the noon part of the hearing. Is just incredible to watch. Leahy he's actually wants to restore the habeas corpus too. He says he will work as long as and as individually as he has to. So I just think that it's important to open this argument, and the people that say well, it happens on TV all the time and we're watching 24 and it works, that's a movie. That is it pumps your adrenaline up, but it may desensitize us to torture. I'm not sure if it does or not. Anyway, thanks for raising the issue, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Steve, as always on this program, every caller leads directly into a topic that we want to discuss. Let's talk about desensitization. And for the first caller who was worried about this becoming too political, I again want to say, watch me. It's not going to do that. Let's talk about desensitization. Every time I watch Law and Order and some young suspect is being interrogated by one of our hero cops and he says, "You don't talk to me, I will put you into a holding cell at Rikers and three 6 foot 8 inch black guys are going to make a wife of you." We sit and take this now as a common element, a trope that we expect in practically every TV drama. In short, ever since Scared Straight, the movie in the early 1980s that showed teenagers being taken to prisons and told by lifers who are there for murder and so forth that if they ever show up in the prison, they will immediately be turned into slaves, raped, abused by other prisoners. This country began down a path of desensitization towards treatment of domestic prisoners more than 25 years ago. And I think that what we're seeing in Abu Ghraib and what we're seeing throughout this whole story is actually something we're all complicit in. And by the way, let me return to the article in the Manchester Guardian written by George Monbiot in December of 2006, just a month ago. Get this sentence. "If we were to judge the U.S. by its penal policies, we would perceive a strange beast, a Christian society that believes in neither forgiveness nor redemption." Now, everyone writing on this subject is happy to say, and I think they're right, that in prisons and in wars, there are always occasions of abuse of prisoners. I now quote from Mark Bowden, the man who was actually rather happy with George Bush's position to keep torture officially illegal but to quietly allow it. Here's a comment in a later article that he wrote for the Wall Street Journal after Abu Ghraib had been revealed, but before we found out that the CIA had secret prisons and was rendering prisoners to Middle Eastern prisons where we knew they were being tortured. Here is Mark Bowden. Quote, "One of the myths of the American soldier is that he never mistreats a captured enemy. If our enemy deadhead voices, a multitude would testify to having been summarily shot, tortured or otherwise abused in every war Americans ever fought. I will interpolate there that accounts of the Pacific War in the Second World War are particularly awful. Let me continue with Bowdoin. Some of the worst examples took place when Americans fought each other. Almost 13,000 Union prisoners died of malnutrition, disease, and exposure at Andersonville Prison in Georgia. As a race, we are no worse or better than anyone else. Where there are prisons, there is prisoner abuse. And where there are prisons in a war zone, whether makeshift ones in the field or the established ones like Abu Ghraib, such behavior is commonplace. War is like that, says Mark Bowdoin. Now, what's the difference since then? He wrote this in November of 2005. Well, since then, Congress has actually given the president the right to use aggressive interrogation techniques. And in part of that legislation passed just toward the end of 2006, a blanket amnesty was given to CIA and military people who had perhaps misunderstood Mr. Rumsfeld and Mr. Bush and the others who first suggested that these techniques be used. And that is the difference, that unlike Bowdoin's picture in which you hold the people who use torture individually responsible and officially condemn it, now we're saying, oh, well, let's just wipe the slate clean and everything that happened for the last 5 years is no longer a problem.
We have another caller waiting on one of the local lines, line number one, which is 333-9455. Yes, you're on Keeping the Faith with David Eisenman.
Yeah, I'd like you to go a little more deeply into the issue of being complicit. I'll even make this somewhat personal. Just for my own frustration and feelings of guilt that, you know, even though throughout my life I've tried to fight against this kind of oppression in many levels. I mean, I was a conscientious objector during the Vietnam War. I have been active in, you know, political movements over the years. I have contacted my, you know, members of Congress. I've given money to candidates who I thought, you know, were in a more positive direction. I've on many different levels tried to, you know, stop this sort of thing, yet still being a citizen of a country that, you know, has a very long and torturous history here. What is, you know, my complicity still in this? And you know, on some extent, I do feel that way.
I think that you're right. We shouldn't be talking about things we can't do anything about. Again, I started to talk to people some weeks ago about coming on this program, and it's kind of interesting the responses I got. Frequently, I was told, oh, for God's sake, don't talk about that. The less said about it, the better. I don't want to know. Or, conversely, isn't this America bashing? Shouldn't we be silent about these things? They've always gone on. We just don't want to know about it. I think that's a response of either people who genuinely haven't thought about it or of people who feel helpless and don't want to be reminded and tortured, again, to use the word in a much milder way, with the notion that they are helpless to do anything about it. Well, if I thought we were helpless, I wouldn't be on this program. First, I think each one of us actually can, it's easier than ever before, send email, phone, put pressure on our representatives in Congress to look into the actual conditions in our prisons, domestic and military. I don't think there's any excuse. I am on jury duty, right? I'm called. I'm actually in a courtroom. I'm observing the behavior of prosecutors and defense attorneys and judges. That's a duty of every citizen. We don't have, you and I don't have the security clearances to know what is going on in military prisons, but by God, members of Congress do. And if they are our representatives and we have elected them to go there, I think they owe it to us to see for themselves what is going on. There's been no congressional oversight. The whole store was handed over to the commander-in-chief at the beginning of this exercise back in 2001, and we have to demand that in a democracy, a representative democracy, our representatives start representing us again. But they won't do it if they think that the majority of us secretly want torture. Now, that polls show that something like 38 or 40% of American people are quite happy to have suspects slapped around if it will lead to useful information. I don't even want to discuss today whether torture ever leads to useful information. There's an overwhelming literature suggesting that it isn't all that effective. But putting that aside, we were talking about ethics, whether it's right behavior. The author, by the way, of the book, in a sense, that we're reviewing today, Ghost Planes, Stephen Gray, says himself that after 9/11, like many people, he began to wonder if whether the gloves shouldn't come off. He quotes from an article written by Jonathan Alter just a month or two after 9/11, and listen to this. Shouldn't we at least subject them to psychological torture like tapes of dying rabbits or high decibel rap? The military has done that in Panama and elsewhere, says this liberal guy. How about truth serum administered with a mandatory IV? Some people still argue that we needn't rethink any of our old assumptions about law enforcement, but they're hopelessly September 10, living in a country that no longer exists. We can't legalize physical torture. It's contrary to American values. But even as we continue to speak out against human rights abuses around the world, we need to keep an open mind about certain measures to fight terrorism, like court-sanctioned psychological interrogation. And we'll have to think about transferring some suspects to our less squeamish allies, even if that's hypocritical. Nobody said this was going to be pretty. End of quote from a man who ought to be massively ashamed of himself by now, Jonathan Alter. And the author of the book says, you know, I got to thinking that way myself. Then, of course, he found out about the secret CIA flights and started following them, locating people who had been in those prisons, and became appalled. And let me tell you what he says after 280 pages of laying out what we've actually been up to. And I think this comes back to what it is to be a citizen in a country that claims to be a beacon to other countries. Let me give you his own conclusion. This point was, well, actually, he quotes at the end of the official book. There's an epilogue, and I'll tell you what he says at the end of that. But here he is quoting an ex-CIA officer who has thought about this for 35 years. Jack Devine, a former acting head of global operations and a veteran of covert action in both Latin America and Afghanistan, he retired in 1999 as London station chief, had no knowledge of any kind of torture sanctioned by the CIA in the war on terror. At the point he interviewed him, it was before all this other stuff came out. His words, though, serve as a warning. Torture is like a cancer, he said. It eats you up and puts you on the same level as those you might oppose. Psychologically, it could leave those involved as walking wounded. As he once put it to me, my worry is, what happens to our people? After the execution, what do you do with the executioner? You might be amused to know, by the way, that Adolf Hitler was quite concerned about the mental health of the Germans who ran the extermination camps. This isn't nice work.
Well, I'd just like to interject that actually the research has shown that psychological torture is much more damaging than physical torture.
Yes.
People who think that psychological torture is, like the lighter side of torture are absolutely wrong in that, and a lot of research has gone into, on the part of the CIA, into how to make torture more effective, and they really did find that it's the psychological part of it that is the greater part of the torture, much more so than the physical part of it.
You're completely right. The book Battle for the Mind came out in 1956, and it demonstrated all of the brain, the so-called brainwashing techniques. These were the words used in those days. Jose Padilla. Let's go back to Jose Padilla. Let me again read to you from this only weeks-old article from The Guardian. After thousands of years of practice, you might have imagined that every possible means of inflicting pain had already been devised, but you should never underestimate the human capacity for invention. United States interrogators, we now discover, have found a new way of destroying a human being. Last week, defense lawyers acting for Jose Padilla released a video showing a mission fraught with deadly risk, taking him to the prison dentist. A group of masked guards in riot gear shackled his legs and hands, blindfolded him with blackout goggles, and shut off his hearing with headphones, then marched him down the prison corridor. Is Padilla really that dangerous, says the article. This is George Monbiot in the Manchester Guardian, December 12, 2006. To continue, far from it. His warders describing him as so docile and inactive that he could be mistaken for a piece of furniture. The purpose of these measures appeared to be to sustain the regime under which he had lived for more than 3 years, total sensory deprivation. He'd been kept in a blacked-out cell, unable to see or hear anything beyond it. Most importantly, he had had no human contact except for being bounced off the walls from time to time by his interrogators. As a result, he appears to have lost his mind. I don't mean this metaphorically. I mean that his mind is no longer there. The forensic psychiatrist who examined him says that he does not appreciate the nature and consequences of the proceedings against him, is unable to render assistance to counsel, and has impairments in reasoning as a result of a mental illness, that is, post-traumatic stress disorder complicated by the neuropsychiatric effects of prolonged isolation. Jose Padilla appears to have been lobotomized, not medically, but socially. If that doesn't underscore what you just said, I don't know what could.
Caller, thank you very much. We appreciate your comments and questions. This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly call-in show. It's live every Sunday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central Time here on WILL AM 580, a listener-supported radio service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm usual host for these programs. I'm a volunteer host for this program. My profession, my job right now, is being director of the University YMCA, which is the oldest charity in this county, the oldest continuous student program at the University of Illinois, started back in 1873. And since that time, the Y has been helping students, male, female, Christian, non-Christian, learn leadership skills by providing opportunities for social action, community service. One of the Y programs is Amnesty International. And at the University of Illinois, the students involved in that program are concerned about these kinds of issues. And incidentally, Amnesty International gave an award to the journalist who wrote Ghost Planes, the book that David is talking with us today, Stephen Gray, G-R-E-Y. Coming up at the Y, starting this semester, is Communiversity classes. If you'd be interested in looking at some of these non-credit classes, some for fun, some to learn something new, all very inexpensive, do check out the University Y website. That's universityymca.org. And look under Communiversity. If you don't have access to the web, do stop by the Y at 1001 South Wright Street and pick up a Communiversity catalog. They're also in local libraries, the religious foundations, and other places around the campus. Today on Keeping the Faith, our guest is David Eisenman, who is also part-time employed at the Y as director of the Bailey Scholarship Program. David, tell us a word or two about the Bailey Scholarship Program in case there are parents or students who might not have heard of it.
Fred S. Bailey was president of the Champaign National Bank. I'm sure that it still exists. It's under probably its fourth or fifth successive name since it was called the Champaign National Bank.
Now,
but in any case,
now it's Main Street Bank and Trust, soon to be merged with Busey.
I don't write down the name of my bank anymore. I don't know if anybody does. No one can remember the name of his bank. But Fred was a good old-fashioned local banker, and when he died, he left a cool $1 million. To be precise, $1,006,000 in a perpetual trust, two-thirds of the income of which support scholarships for worthy, moral young people at the University of Illinois. And that program was entrusted to the University of Illinois YMCA on Wright Street. I am the third director of the program since 1957. I'm a part-time program director. We accept applications from students who are at the University of Illinois Champaign, who have financial need that is not being met by other programs, and who are the sort who demonstrate an interest in the helping of other people and the improvement of society. Generally speaking, everyone who qualifies on those criteria gets an award. So it's worth filling out our 1950s type of application with an autobiographical essay and letters of recommendation. It can be found online at www.mathware.com/Bailey. But don't worry about that. You can call me at home if you need information later.
And you can also go to the University YMCA website and find a link to the Bailey Scholarship Program. Students need to remember that this is a gift. This is not a loan. And a lot of people will make you loans and be happy to accept, take interest from you for years to come. But this is because of the generosity of Fred Bailey. The Y can give this money away completely to students, up to $3,000 a year. So over 3 or 4 or 5 years of student life can be very helpful. So do please apply. Well, let's get back to our topic for today, which is the ethics of torture. And let me give the phone numbers again. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Elsewhere, if it's a long-distance call, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. And that includes listeners within the continental U.S. who are listening to this program live through their computers at WILL.UIUC.edu. Incidentally, coming up next week on this program, Mike Mulberry will be talking about participating in an emergency delegation to Oaxaca, Mexico. Frank Dimmock from Malawi will be here February 4th talking about health issues in southern Africa. Later in February, Michael Shapiro talking about whether the St. John's Passion is anti-Semitic, and Rick Layton talking about the Gospel of John as the basis for Bach's musical work. And then on March 4th, Chet Always talking about the music involved in the St. John's Passion, which will be performed by the Bach group here in Champaign-Urbana early in March. So those are some of the programs coming up. But for today, talking about the ethics of torture. David, where are we going next?
Well, let's go back to the very first caller who I think was pushing me to make a statement about ethics in general of the use of torture. So let me do that. Where have I come out after thinking about this intently for 2 years, ever since Mark Bowden's piece in The Atlantic? I guess I'll say that I was attracted to Bowden's article, or his argument, his final position, which is that if we all agree that torture is something that almost always we want to avoid, and that anybody who uses it in our name had better be prepared to stand trial for having broken a firm rule. I liked that position. What it effectively said was never say never. Say very rarely, say almost never, but keep in mind the possibility that the greater harm might be done in some difficult situation, the so-called ticking time bomb problem, where you have in front of you someone you know, without a shadow of a doubt, has information that could save lives and who is unwilling to give it to you. I was, as I say, vaguely attracted, maybe even somewhat respectful of that position. But now I'd like to read to you what Stephen Gray ended up concluding after looking in extraordinary detail into what is actually going on and has gone on since then. Here is Stephen Gray's afterword to the book Ghost Plane, The True Story of the CIA Torture Program. He wrote this in September of 2006. That's just barely 4 months ago. Last paragraph. America's programs of extraordinary renditions and harsh treatments for prisoners have not, when considered strategically, been weapons against terrorism. Every time a new repressive measure is approved by Congress or the President, Osama bin Laden must cheer. Ultimately, these are tactics that encourage terrorism and help lose the war. Ignoring human rights helps recruit terrorists, justifies terrorism, and defeats the best thing we have going for us, the fact we stand for something better, for freedom, tolerance, and laws that protect us all. Now, I think there's a lot to that, and I'm reminded, and someone else has been reminded, of Sissela Bach's book entitled Lying, which came out 20, 30 years ago. Sissela Bach took an interesting position, which was that lying is never justified. She discussed little white lies. She discussed lies that were there to protect bigger secrets. You know, the Churchill's famous remark in the Second World War that let's see. The truth is so precious in times of war that it needs to be protected by a bodyguard of lies. His remark was made with respect to the D-Day invasion. If the Germans could be misled as to where that invasion was going to take place, there was a chance it might succeed. But frankly, the Allies knew that the Germans were entrenched well enough in France that if they really put everything they had on the beaches of Normandy, we would not, in fact, succeed. And as you know from having seen movies and read about it, the D-Day invasion was a close call. But Sisselbach came to the conclusion that the very existence of lying undercuts human communication, because once you know that other people lie, you find yourself doubting almost all the time whether you're being told the full truth. Bowdoin's position was that you should use torture very sparingly, but it's okay to let the enemy think you use it a lot so that when he is in fact captured, he can sit there and imagine that you're going to be hooking his genitals up to a generator or slicing him with your razor blades or whatever. It was a lovely picture, except that unfortunately we didn't restrain ourselves, apparently. And in any case, torture is rather like the use of nuclear weapons in war games. The Army found out, and the Navy and the Air Force, in the 70s, that if you put leaders of our armed forces together in rooms and you built scenarios in which we're being attacked by the Soviet Union or whoever, some nameless, faceless enemy, if you made nuclear weapons available to them and then the scenario went along in such a way that there was a moment of extreme danger to our forces, inevitably, if nuclear weapons were available, our people used them. Every war game ever played where nuclear weapons were on the table spiraled out of control into a nuclear holocaust. There are some things that maybe, for all the arguments you can make that occasionally they could be used sparingly, there may be times when certain things ought to be completely off the table. That, however, is not an ethical argument. It's a practical argument. I'll come back to ethics in a minute.
We do have another call waiting on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith.
It's really kind of nice to hear things brought up that have been on my mind since the 40s. The European action, our atomic bombing of Japan, and odd things like supplying the gases to all of the Arabic states, including Saddam Hussein, the remnants of the gas, which are still at Newport, Indiana. I'm delighted to hear that the World Court has been approached to hold some of our officials responsible for the current stuff. But I'd be also happy to hear comment on why some of our past atrocities haven't been addressed, just so that people would know about them, and I'll listen.
Thank you for the call.
I think that would be a great topic for a different program. But as I said at the outset, and I want to keep coming back to, this is about ethics, and I'm talking about my ethics, right and wrong in conduct. For example, I had a choice of what to talk about today, and frankly, the only right topic for me to talk about today was torture. Now, as for what I think every citizen of the United States needs to do right now about this matter, I think there are things we can do. Every time you see a TV program that casually refers to prison brutality as if, of course, that goes on, naturally we approve of it, it's a nice tool to help us when we're interrogating people that might or might not have committed crimes. Every time you see a program like that, write a letter of protest to the creators of that program and to the network that ran it, and tell them that you turned it off at that point. So every commercial you saw after every commercial they ran after that point in the program, you didn't see. I do think we have become insensitized to what goes on in our own jails, prisons, domestically, the way we treat people who might or might not be guilty of things. Do you notice the response to all of these DNA tests that are showing that we have people on death row who clearly couldn't have committed the crime that they're lined up to be executed for? Constantly you hear from the hardliners, well, they didn't commit that crime, but they probably committed something else. It's okay for the police to frame people every once in a while when they know they're guilty. guilty. You're getting him for this thing, which, yeah, maybe he didn't do, but he's certainly done plenty of other things. Those people weren't rounded up just by mistake. Well, you need to read. You need to read Ghost Plane to see, indeed, that we do round up people by mistake. And we're not very good at admitting mistakes. This president may be the least mistake-admitting president in the history of the world. But our whole society has acted for the last 25 years as if we knew what we were doing with respect to locking people up. We have the highest percentage of our population in prison of any country in the world. Back when I first thought about this problem in the 1980s, we're at least in third place. We had wonderful company. We had the Soviet Union and South Africa ahead of us. Well, they don't lock as many people up anymore as we do. For all the things that go on in Chinese prisons, our own are not enviable. There was a talk show in this town not too many seasons ago that had a local judge chatting, and he said something about he wouldn't go near a prison. Those are horrible places, and they're very dangerous in there. I called and said, gee, if they're so bad, don't you feel bad about sending people there? He said, that's not my responsibility. My job is in my courtroom. We are so divided. Responsibility is so neatly delegated out in this country that we have, as citizens, delegated. The president would like you to think we've made him the decider. And he, in turn, sends people for torture off to Syria and Egypt and other countries that are on his own Human Rights Watch list. This outsourcing and pushing of responsibility off endlessly far away is something that I finally can no longer sit still and not say something about. And I'm spending time writing my letters to the editor, calling my congressman. I did call them when the legislation was pending in Congress in the last part of last year to give the president official authority to use advanced interrogation techniques if he thought as commander-in-chief that he should. I was appalled by that legislation. And if we can fault the Germans for what they let Hitler slowly do during the 30s, I think, and I find my elderly friends saying that we are living in the most fraught, dangerous moment that we can recall in our long lifetimes. I'm a young 63, but my 80-year-old friends who remember the McCarthy era feel that civil rights and decency and the moral standing of our country is more in danger right now than it's been any time during their lifetimes.
Some of the books that David has referred to on this program, Ghost Plane by Stephen Gray, G-R-E-Y, by St. Martin's Press, 2006. Cicely Bach on lying. When did that come out roughly, David?
1977.
Okay,
like that,
and Battle for the Mind, William Sargent's classic on psychological torture from the 50s. We're talking with David Eisenman about the ethics of torture. We're getting down close to our end. We could probably sneak in another call or two. 333-9455, Champaign-Urbana, elsewhere 1-800-222-9455. We also should remind people of the film, the important film, The Battle of Algiers.
It's rentable, by the way, from Rentertainment. I'm sure it's available from Netflix. A beautiful new DVD of this movie was released in maybe 2004 or 2005. It's accompanied by two DVDs that actually interview French generals who were involved in the suppression of the rebellion in Algeria and people who were themselves rebels and ended up in the government, the first democratic government of Algeria. By the way, that wasn't a particularly successful government. Democracy isn't always the answer, and not every liberation movement necessarily leads to an improvement in the lives of the ordinary people. But the movie is extraordinary.
Another caller on line number one. You're on Keeping the Faith. Yes, go ahead, line number one.
Okay.
Are you there?
I am.
Yes.
I am, but anyway, I'm Clark Lindsay. Can you hear me?
Yes, now I can hear you. Thank you.
Okay. Anyhow, I wanted to say I really think the previous callers were very, very appropriate, but I tuned in late, so I can't make an intelligent response. But thank you for listening.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you for the call. David, when you think about torture and what people in the United States can do when we hear these reports about our own government, Are there organizations that are particularly concerned with this issue that people could support and sort of join in a larger group that might have more effectiveness than just a single voice?
Human Rights Watch is obviously one. I have seen ads for an organization that does support hospitals that help people who have been tortured. Jean Le Carré has appeared in their ads. Other people in Europe have courageously set up institutions precisely for the rehabilitation of people who are caught in these horrible situations. Torture is used, obviously, by plenty of regimes and plenty of organizations around the world. Our focus today was on whether we as citizens of a democracy don't have individually responsibility for the official torture now being espoused by and authorized by our president supported by an inactive Congress up to this point. But I do think that there's much to be done. We have lost so much moral ground in the last 4 years in the world. Our own consciences should be bothering us. I think there's going to be a lot to do in the next few years for the victims of torture, ours and other people's, and for our own exterminating the celebration of torture as part of the entertainment industry. Movies, television, newspapers, we have become way too callous, and it's time to kick back and stop allowing torture to be a routine element of every crime story that comes our way.
We mentioned earlier Amnesty International, which in Champaign-Urbana is a program of the University YMCA. You can go to the Y website to learn about Amnesty International, various events here locally. And within the state of Illinois, Protestants for the Common Good has a division that works with the issue of prisons in this state. And Illinois has had a sordid record in terms of prisoners on death row who turned out to be innocent. We're down to the last few seconds.
Let's finish with an actual description of waterboarding by somebody who was waterboarded in Algeria. This is just two paragraphs long. "Do you know how to swim?" said Lowe, bending over me, speaking as Henri Alleg, a French journalist. "We're going to teach you. Take him to the tap." Together, they picked up the plank to which I was attached and carried me into a kitchen. They rested the top of the plank where my head was against the sink. Lowe fixed a rubber tube to the metal tap, which shone just above my face. He wrapped my head in a rag and held my nose. He tried to jam a piece of wood between my lips in such a way that I could not close my eyes, my mouth, or spit out the tube. When everything was ready, he said to me, "When you want to talk, all you have to do is move your fingers." And he turned on the tap. He then goes on to describe how he really thought he was dying, and he had to move his fingers.
That will be our last word from our guest today, David Eisenman. We've been talking about the ethics of torture. Next week on Keeping the Faith, our guest will be Reverend Mike Mulberry, talking about his being part of a recent delegation, emergency delegation, to Oaxaca, Mexico. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the usual host for Keeping the Faith programs. Thank you for listening.
You've been listening to Keeping the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Christopher Hogwood was not your ordinary household pet. For one thing, he weighed 700 pounds, and he loved to drink beer. Christopher was a very large pig with a heart of gold. And Jim Fleming, next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the story of how Christopher Hogwood became the best-loved pig in southern New Hampshire. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 7 here on WILL Urbana. AM 580 has a listener comment line. If you'd like to comment on something you hear on the Information Advantage, call 217-333-0853 and leave a message. That's 217-333-0853. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, cloudy with patchy dense fog and scattered flurries or patchy freezing drizzle. The low in the lower 20s with light winds becoming northwest around 10 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, cloudy with scattered flurries, the high around 30 degrees with northwest winds around 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with scattered flurries, the low around 19 degrees with west winds around 10 miles per hour. It's 6 p.m. This American Life is next.
Okay, one sign that you and your high school nerd friends are pulling a lot of pranks, you give yourselves a name.